a slight change in the agenda in that Representative Kitz is here, and we have one of his bills on the list, that being House Bill 3463, committee. So we'll take House Bill 3463 first, and then we'll go back up to the top of the list and go right down the schedule. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3463, and I'll ask Representative Kitz to come forward, please. Committee, we have four people to testify, all in favor of this bill, and all sitting in front of you at the moment. So.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for agreeing to hear this bill today. This is a simple little bill. I would tell you it's a technical fix, but nobody would believe that anyway since you hear it every day. Colleagues, House Bill 3463 came to me out of my participation in my new hobby, which is a lot less dangerous and a little bit easier than bull riding, although I don't have either of them mastered quite yet. So I'm hoping with the help of my esteemed colleagues and good friends that you will show my good friends here that I'm a better legislator than I am a bull rider. So, colleagues, I'm going to pass out some photos just so that you have some semblance of what it is that I'm talking about.
That will probably not be that difficult a job, Representative.
I'm not so sure about that, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, what I have here is a sequential photo of what was my very first race out of Pat's Acres Complex, and you will see where I was obviously cut off, which enabled me to drive up and into and over this poor individual that cut me off. So the evidence is clear. And if you disagree with whether or not he cut me off, he owns it. Colleagues, House Bill 3463 comes to you from me via my good friends Chris and Lisa Eggers and their son Brady, who's here today. They're the owners and operators of Pat's Acres Raceway in Candy, Oregon. The problem is the racetrack, the way that it's zoned currently on its conditional use, is zoned for go-karts only. And what I've provided there is a picture of what, when we're talking about go-karts, we're not talking about wooden crates with wheels nailed to those wooden crates. We're talking about 125-mile-an-hour race cars that are the breeding ground for NASCAR drivers, IndyCar drivers, and every other form of auto racing alike. I've also included an aerial photo of the existing complex. The problem, as described, is this facility is only allowed to operate racing carts at this time. And what we're asking the committee for is permission to allow these folks, these hardworking Oregonians, these business owners of Oregon, to operate other forms of motorized vehicles only that are conducive to the existing track. And the reason for the aerial photo of the track is you can see that we're not talking NASCAR, we're not talking dragsters, we're talking a very select number of items that could potentially be conducive to such a track. We're not asking for an expansion of the track, nor are we asking for an expansion of the hours. Simply allowing these folks to, what it boils down to, is allowing motorcycles in conjunction with go-karts to race on this track. So with that, I'm more than happy to let Chris and Lisa Eger testify for the committee and answer any questions at that time. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill today.
State your name for the record. My name is Chris Eger, owner of Pat's Acres Racing Complex. Really, the only thing that we're looking to expand, and one of the main reasons that we feel we need to expand the use, is we get calls from pocket bike owners, moms, kids with motorcycles, that they want someplace where they can come ride that's off the streets, not on the, not in the mall parking lot, not up and down the you know, the parkway and the apartment. And at this point in time, we have to tell them, no, we can't. We know the track, you know, is very suitable for the vehicles they're driving, but it's not a, an allowed use for us right now. And so we have to tell a lot of those people that, no, we can't allow them to do that. And we'd just like a little more latitude to be able to run something out there that is, you know, conducive to the facility. I was telling Representative Kitts earlier that, you know, the go-karts are probably the noisiest thing out there that would use the facility, and we're not looking to expand the hours of operation. We're sort of looking to be able to replace some of that noisy time with a little bit less noisy time.
Ms. Zager, did you wish to speak?
Do you wish to say anything?
Brady said good bill should pass.
Committee, have any questions of the Yeager family or Representative Kitts? Representative Anderson. Representative Ackerman. Just a couple of questions. Are you operating under a conditional use permit now?
Yes.
And it just restricts you to this one type of go-kart type vehicle?
Correct.
And you want to expand just to motorcycles?
Well, motorcycles or anything else that is conducive to using the track. You know, there may be some electrical, you know, electric carts or something else that comes down the road. We're not looking to expand the track. We're not looking to, you know, go further than that. We just want to be able to run anything that's safe, you know, on the track.
Representative Ackerman, if I could expand on that, the current venue that is applicable in this situation would in fact be motorcycles. However, there are, as you've seen, there are these scooters, these two-wheeled scooters that have an engine on it that need a place to run. There are these pocket bikes, which are not motorcycles, but little kids' pocket bikes. So the broadness of the language was for that reason, that we didn't want to have to come back and get every single item that could potentially ever maybe in the future conducive to the track. And that's why we said conducive to the existing track, not wanting to expand it to allow, you know, the dragsters or whatever the case may be, NASCAR, Indy cars, just simply the existing track, anything that may or may not be, you know, that may be, you know, suitable for that use. That's why the broadness of the language.
Okay. And my other question is, have your constituents gone to the county and sought this expansion under the conditional use permit, and if so, what was the result?
It was the original reason why the restriction was placed on the facility was via the county. We had no satisfaction, and I'll let Chris explain what the genesis of that process was and how we came to be here today.
Well, 5 or 6 years ago, we had a promoter come to us, and he wanted to race some motorcycles out on in the back pasture. And they smoothed out the dirt, put a fence around it. They were speedway motorcycles, and he started racing on Friday nights and had a pretty good following. He was told, make sure by 10 o'clock at night that you're done, you're shut down, you know, to stay in alignment with all the noise ordinances. He exceeded the time a couple weeks in a row, and a couple of the neighbors, there's very, very few neighbors that are even within earshot, but a couple of them complained, which, you know, rightfully so. We got dragged into a county hearing. The county in that hearing was trying to eliminate the use of that dirt track. And in their decision, the wording came down that said, you know, motorcycles, dirt carts, ATVs, quads are not allowed to operate at the facility. And the intention of what they were trying to do was limit or restrict and make that dirt track in the back go away. And it technically limited us from using, you know, putting motorcycles on the other track, which had raced them. They have raced off and on for, you know, 35, 40 years.
Representative Ackerman, the aerial photo that I passed around was simply an overhead photo of the existing track, not the entire property. So the entire property, what Mr. Eger is referring to, was the back section, flatland, that someone just came in there and graded down.
I sort of think my question's answered. Have you gone back to the county and asked them to expand the conditional use permit to to allow you to run the type of vehicle that you're seeking to do through this bill? That should be a yes or no answer.
Yes. The county said that they'd ruled on it, and that was where they were at. It was the county attorney, not the county commission.
So this bill overrides the county commissioner's decision?
Not, I don't know if it's the county commissioner's decision, Representative, because it had never gone before the county commission. It was an inspector from the county came out and said, this track wasn't here, this is new, you've exceeded the existing parameters for this use, X, Y, and Z. They've since shut that track down and said no more motorcycles can be raced at the complex. Well, the complex existing, they've been there since 1969. The other that they shut down, which in totality is Pat's Acres Racing Complex, applies now. So, yes, we are coming to you now. Okay, in light of that.
Representative Summer.
No.
Any other questions? Representative Greenlee.
The section that defines a racing vehicle is really pretty much wide open. I mean, what does it mean to be suitable for the type of track?
Well, Representative, I think I passed around the aerial photo, and that was the reason for that, is so you can see and visualize what that track is. And so what we're saying is obviously it's a very, very limited number of vehicles, motorized, that could actually race on that track. So anything that's, you know, conducive, when I say that, motorcycles are conducive to that track, but 10 years ago we didn't have these type of motorcycles. It's been a genesis of what's called the X Games now, an alternative type sports that now these motorcycles run on these types of tracks. Well, you also have these pocket bikes that I spoke of that could be conducive to that track. You have scooters that people stand on and that have motorized, that there's a racing league for these. So it's a very small number of things, but instead of trying, and that's why it says motorized vehicles that are conducive to that existing track, not wanting to expand it to include anything else, but simply the track that exists and any motorized vehicle that would be conducive to that track.
Yeah, it may be obvious to you because you have some knowledge, but in the statute, I can say it isn't obvious to me. I mean, maybe explain to me why Indy cars, they can't run on that track.
Why what?
Why Indy cars can't run on that track. I mean,
Indy cars are too big to race on that track. NASCARs are too big to race on that track, and that's why. And yeah, I don't care what race is on the track. If it can fit on the track and it's legal and it's safe, I don't care what it is. And that was not my, you know, my intention was to allow these folks to sanction races for any motorized vehicle that's conducive to that track. That's exactly right. Any motorized vehicle.
Full-size cars won't fit. The track is about 20 to 22 feet wide, and the total length around the track is just under 0.6 mile. So, I mean, a full-size car, you can't hardly fit, you know, two full-size vehicles side by side.
There's an alternative this type, you know what I'm saying? So it's not conducive.
Well, my point is it may be obvious with your knowledge, but it's not obvious in terms of statutory knowledge. But I think if what you're suggesting is it ought to be any kind of vehicle.
That's what I'm suggesting. Any type of vehicle that is conducive to that track, I'm asking to be allowed within the hours of operation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newell.
Maybe this will help clarify it. The statute is silent on who determines what's compatible. Who decides if a vehicle is compatible with this particular track?
I think the track decides that.
Follow up if I may. But the bill also seems silent on any improvements that the track might make that could change what vehicles are.
Absolutely. We've gotten permission from the county and have expanded the area. The county doesn't have a problem with us expanding the track. They've allowed us to do that. We've expanded it twice in the last 4 years. So they've never had a problem with us expanding the existing track.
And it's also not where we're at, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan. We're specifying that the track as is shall be allowed, you know, not, like I said, by the track. The track is the determining factor in what is allowed to be on that track. And like I've stated, there are turns on that track that are tighter than what would be this dais up here. So obviously, by that factor alone, you couldn't have a full-size car on that track. It wouldn't be conducive to that track. And that's what the language, although it's not, I don't see it as being vague, I'm saying that the track determines what's conducive, and I don't, the ability to put something that is not conducive on there is not an ability.
Mr. Chair, when you say the track, I don't think the asphalt actually talks to us. And you said that there's a disagreement between the operator and the county over this use. So in that case, who gets to decide? The county? Or is there a state agency that needs to get involved? Or does the operator of the track decide unilaterally?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, I think that's a great question. What we're talking about is this existing track. What we talked about prior was a track that was put in after this track, that the promoter had come in and put a separate track on Pat's Acres complex, conducive to off-road motorcycles, and was promoting and broke the existing rules and was subsequently shut down. So that was an entirely different track than the track we were speaking of.
One of the other controlling factors that comes into play for us is the insurance company. They're very, very strict about, you know, I mean, we have to cover our tail. It's, you know, that's just the way it is. And they're very, very restrictive on what they will allow us to run on the track. So it's not like we can go out and, you know, dream something up new you know, there's a lot of hoops. There has to be a national organization. There has to be rules set in place. There's got to be a lot of other things that have to fall into place, or the insurance company will not let us put them on the track. So really, one of the biggest limiting factors there is what will the insurance company let us do?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative, to elaborate just a little bit further, on Section 1, it's a subject to subsection of this section, a motorsports racetrack that existed. So we're talking about existing facilities. We're not trying to... we're not doing it. They're asking us to go back to the way that it was and put in that other track that was shut down. That's not what the intention of the bill is. The intention of the bill is just to simply allow for any motorized vehicle that's conducive to that existing track to be permitted to run there.
I think this is the last one.
Follow.
So just to make sure we understand, when you say a motorsports race track in this bill, you mean the physical layout of the course, not the business operation of the track?
Correct.
As to what exists?
Correct.
This set of pavement?
Yes.
Thanks.
Can I follow that?
Representative Ackerman, just when I... This bill would allow you to run the track until 10 o'clock every night, subject to suitable lighting. Is that also an expanded use, or do you have lighting there now, and are you operating until 10 o'clock every night now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, there is currently lighting there and has been lighting there. My understanding is that when the county came out, they said, yes, you have lighting, no, you can't use it. Why can't I use the lighting that's existing on my facility? Because you can't prove to us that the lighting was used for that. You can prove that it was here, but you can't prove that it was used for that purpose.
They said you can't prove it was used to extend your hours of operation.
Yes. So that's why we're stating that if in fact there are current lighting, and you can see there's current lighting there, it allows them to operate until 10, which is currently the noise ordinance of the city.
Operating with illumination?
No.
So if that's an expanded use is what I'm trying to get at, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlee.
So it's expanded use for vehicles and expanded use for time.
That's a tricky question, Representative. The time allows for you to operate until 10 p.m. But the track facility with the existing lights are not permitted to be used. So we're not asking because of lights to be excused. We're asking to use the lights to use the track for what's currently approved. We can operate. If you want to go run in the dark, it wouldn't be the safest of things, and I'm sure that Chris would probably get shut down and the insurance company wouldn't like it. But it currently is a permitted use.
Okay. But from a neighbor's perspective, this is both an expansion of the kind of vehicles that can race and an expansion in the hours that you could race as a matter of the statute, both changing what the county wants to have happen now.
Well, I guess the short answer is yes, but the reality of the situation is if they wanted to put headlights on these carts and race them at night until 10 o'clock, they could currently do that.
Mr. Chair, a further question, please. Didn't I hear you say that the track has been changed twice since 1969 in terms of the physical layout?
It's been added to with the asphalt.
So the definition of being able, being the same physical track that Representative Kitz has suggested is you're not the same physical track you were in 1969. You have a different physical track than you had in 1969.
The original layout is still there. It's just had loops added to it.
The existing track is there.
That's correct. The existing track is still there.
But you're not running on the existing track.
Yes. No, we are. The existing track was approximately, say, 3/8 of a mile long. There's other loops that have been added to it, and we can run it in different configuration. Every configuration that we run utilizes that original 3/8 of a mile, but we can also branch out to change the layout.
Yeah. So, Representative Kitz said exactly the same asphalt that was there in 1969. Now you're saying you've gone from 3/8 of a mile to 5/8 of a mile. Although you're using the same 3/8, so you could extend it to 2 miles and use the same 3/8, and that would argue that would be covered under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, obviously any expansion of the track has to go through the appropriate process, but with reference to this bill, the existing track, as was mentioned in the bill since 1969, is the same exact track. It's the same exact track that my father raced on in 1971 and 1969 through 71. The expansion of the track incorporates two stretches, and my understanding is that the big flooding of the Pudding River, which floods every year, was part of the reason why they had to rebuild and extend it at that point in time.
You're saying originally that it's exactly the one that was 69 and that's all you're talking about.
I never stated that it was exactly the one in 69.
So now you're saying this track could be any track they could expand as long as they had the original 3/8 of a mile in it?
Well, I think that's accurate. I think that this is the existing track from 1969 is the original track. The expansions that have been made on the track were as a result of the Pudding River, which flows right next to the track flooding. And if, in fact, the owners wanted to expand the track on the existing property, there would be nothing that would prohibit them from doing that, with the exception they have to go through the county and permitting process, which would be a whole different issue. But Representative Green, to answer your question, the existing track as is the track that was there in 1969 in its totality.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Gerard.
Thank you. Elder family.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3463 and open a work session on House Bill 3463.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3463 to the floor with the pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 3463 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to oppose this because I don't think the record has been sufficiently treated here this afternoon. I have heard nothing from the neighbors. We hear nothing from the county's position on this. It appears to me that this is an expanded use of this facility in terms, particularly in terms of the lighting and the permissible vehicles which would be allowed thereon. I could think of two similar situations where we have allowed exceptions for existing uses in farm use property. One was a bill allowing a current fireworks facility to stay in place. And another one was, I think, in this session, the Representative Balto's bill allowing the local correction office that was sited on land, on farmland, to stay there without having to go through conditional use processes of the county because they've been there for a long period of time. My point being that in these two examples, we were not expanding the use, we were basically confirming existing use. I think when we're expanding local use, an existing use, we need more input from neighbors, from the county, and I have a feeling that we're overriding some county decision on this and feel very, very reluctant to vote in favor of the bill under those circumstances. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I have the same problem. I don't think this is a question of land use, excuse the farmers or anything else. I think this is a question of a business that has the potential for being disruptive. And I think the notion of overriding the county commission, taking away this decision, we work very hard to keep local control in place. And it doesn't feel very comfortable to me for us, the state legislature, for us to preempt the county on a decision that I think essentially is a local decision. And I'll be voting no as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only problem would be that, being as this is EFU, if it was really high quality land, I'd have more qualms. But this is an established business, been there for 30 years. The people who are neighbors know the use, and if there are noise problems, I think they know that it's already been a, if it's been a nuisance, they know about it. And I think it's up to the county commissioners to limit it from here on out, but I'm in favor of doing what they're doing.
Representative Summer.
Sir, knowing this property very well, passing it each day, to characterize it as EFU or good farmland is facetious at best. Most of the time in the winter you could race boats there. It's underwater a good deal of the time, and they have put the best and highest use, in my opinion, to that property. It allows a good place for young children to recreate in a safe facility. It's very well disciplined and very well controlled by the people that operate it. I'm gonna vote in favor of this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
No.
Greenlee?
No.
Nolan?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Sumner?
Yes.
Chair votes
aye. House Bill 3463 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We will close the work session on House Bill 3463. Representative Kitts, would you like to carry this bill?
Be more than
Representative Kitts will carry the bill and will close the work session on House Bill 3463. And we will open a work session on House Bill 3286. And is Joe Willis here? Joe, would you come up and...
Mr. Chair, well, I have joined with me Michael Kerr. He's the deputy executive director of NAPUSL, our Chicago office, who has worked with me on this in the interim since we were here last.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Bob Danko,
please come forward. Is there a background on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is something you previously heard in early April. This is established, was referred to as a Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, and specifically this would deal with the topic of what's called brownfields. Those are sites that have some kind of chemical contamination on them, and then the part of the remediation process, the properties can lie fallow for some number of years by seeking to employ environmental covenants. covenant would allow the transfer of the property from one owner to another owner. We would then be able to continue its remediation. It would not assume liability issues would be able to be covered, and it could allow for some kind of use of the property, hopefully turned into some kind of business type of use, owing to certain type of what may or may not be able to safely be put on the property given the contaminated aspects. You have received, we provided, I think, to each one of you, a copy of the Dash 1 amendments. We received these quite late, and I think they were drafted by, I believe, Mr. Kerr, who is advocating the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act in a number of states in this year and last year, and I suppose in probably the next several years.
Willis, we'll let you start off.
Well, Chair Gerard and members of the committee, thank you. We were here last. Mr. Danko has suggested a slowdown. My preference was, let's try to get this finished this session because of what's occurring around us. The chair asked if we would meet and try to have some informational meeting with some constituencies that were suggested by the DEQ. We did do that. That meeting was conducted where we had the benefit of Mr. Kerr, but we also had the benefit of the chair of the drafting committee and a professor who was the resident expert who was called our reporter on that drafting committee. Plus, we had a representative from the United States Environmental Protection Office out of Washington, D.C., offering information and input about this bill. And we go back before that, and let me remind you that the Uniform Law Conference, the National Conference, works through first a Scope and Program Committee, where someone has brought to the Scope and Program Committee a need for some sort of a state bill. The Uniform Conference is an voluntary association of states who are trying to solve some of the problems short of turning everything over to the federal government for resolution. That Scope and Program Committee first studied this, looked at what states were doing, looked at the need for uniformity, and then that Scope and Program Committee took on the project, and it appointed a drafting committee, which were people of diverse backgrounds, and that drafting committee had the ability with some staff to bring on a resident expert law professor in the environmental law field, and then also to go out and bring in advisors and observers. And they met usually by getting on an airplane Thursday night, flying somewhere and locking themselves up in a room until Sunday afternoon, going through the wording that comes out of this bill. They put together drafts. That draft was brought into the floor of the National Conference of Commissioners, some probably 250 lawyers around the country who would be on the floor, where the bill was read line by line and vigorously debated. And sometimes it was sent back to that drafting committee for further work and resolution, and we went through that process until finally the conference was satisfied with the bill. It sent it over to then the ABA, which has always had at least one advisor, sometimes two, that are very active in the substantive area we're working with. The ABA House of Delegates also approved the bill, and it was sent out to the states with the Uniform Law Conference recommending it be adopted. Now, I say that because that was sort of the vetting that was gone through before it ever came to Oregon. Once it was through that process, that was 2 years ago, I believe, and Mr. Kerr was involved in this, the National Conference sponsored a seminar in Portland where this bill was featured. I know the DEQ representatives had seen it at least that long ago. And then, as my role as a Uniform Law Commissioner from the state of Oregon this year, I asked that this bill be introduced, and that went through the process and went through the legislative council process, and we ultimately came to you. Now, I think it's also fair to say that given the meeting that we did have, where we had, I don't know, 10 or 12 additional people, all local, that were primarily consultants and lawyers and the DEQ agency people, we had a lawyer there from the Port of Portland and others that were interested in this. I think it's fair to say that the DEQ and a couple other people look at this and says, gosh, this is a lot to bite off so quickly. Can we slow down? Can we wait? Can we study this more? And I think that was basically the same position the DEQ expressed to me when we were here before. Because my preference is still to urge this committee to pass this out with a new pass resolution, primarily for this reason. This has been this bill has truly been vetted on a national basis and in Oregon previously. And I worry that if we were back here with the buy-in by the legislature 2 years from now, a couple of things might happen. I'm still concerned that some of the people that I heard in my conference room saying, could we just have a while to study this? If we went in the same bill 2 years from now, I think we'd probably get the same reaction. And that's just a notion. I say that from 30-some years' experience of being a reform law commissioner and watching this process. And I don't say that in any way to denigrate their positions. I think it's just that it's human nature. And secondly, and more importantly, if there's a map in the informational packets with respect to the states around us and what they're doing, this bill is in the legislature in Nevada. It's scheduled to go into the legislature next year in Idaho, Washington, and California. We do not have a session next year. And it's a good bill. I've heard no substantive criticism from it from any quarter, none whatsoever. And I'm just concerned that if we have an opportunity to have a bill that has had this much work go into it to try to get some of these properties back into the stream of commerce that are that safely so and make them productive, I don't want my home state being looked at and saying, well, what's wrong with Oregon when everybody else around me has passed this? So I think we'd miss an opportunity if we didn't take it now. And the other thing I'll do, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Kerr, is remind everybody, this doesn't change any of the regulatory law, doesn't change any of the land use law. It's completely an overlay bill, and it is, in that sense, consensual. But the agency doesn't want to use it to take advantage of the parameters of what it can do for these perpetual environmental covenants. It doesn't have to, because it does require consensual agreements to enter into the covenant. They cannot be imposed. So I would urge the committee to have a due pass recommendation. And let me turn it over to Mr. Kerr, because the amendments that are before you, if you recall also, and I was here before, somehow through the drafting process and legislative counsel's office, it didn't come out exactly as the uniform bill was drafted. The effort was to get legislative counsel to correct that. We believe that has now occurred with some very, very small, insignificant stylistic changes. I think that Mr. Kerr is satisfied that we do have before you, with the amendments, the Uniform Act.
Welcome, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Mike Kerr. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for NACUSL. We're based in Chicago, not Washington, and we work for the states. We're funded by the states. We're not a special interest group. We really don't have a dog in this fight, so to speak. We're not an environmental position taker in terms of the black and white of these issues. But what we are is a gathering of folks with an awful lot of expertise in things like real property law, contracts, commercial law, commercial development, and a wide variety of other things. You know, anything that's got uniform in front of it is something that we've worked on. Let me say a few things about uniformity in this bill, and just I want to just sort of go over what this bill does, just in a nutshell. This is an optional tool. Nobody has to use this, but we think it's a better tool. And by that I mean more reliable. When you have contaminated properties, regardless of whose fault it was for the contamination, regardless of where it's located, regardless of who has jurisdiction, US EPA, the department here in Oregon, it's in everyone's interest to, number one, get that property back into the stream of commerce, and number two, to make sure that if long-term controls need to be put on that property, that they're going to stay in place as long as they need to be. And a number of states, before we finished this project on Eureka, have been addressing that problem. And they've addressed it in a number of ways. Some states have done equitable servitudes. Some states have done regulatory orders. Some states have put up a notice system. And some states, the solution they've come up with independently have been, frankly, better in some states than others. What Eureka brings to the table is some expertise in real property law. One of the things that our chair of the project is fond of saying is that there are two populations of lawyers that really never met each other. Sludge lawyers, that is, environmental attorneys, and dirt lawyers, real property folks. And I can talk about the difference in philosophy of those two groups of attorneys, but basically most of the states that have dealt with this have figured out that the best way to handle it is to record a use limitation in the title of the property. So that gives notice to potential buyers, and if you have a statutory hook that says it's going to run with the land, it'll run with the land. And in fact, Oregon law has a provision on that. It's 465, I think 327, does that, at least with part of your law. But what most of the statutes that precede UECA don't do is think about some of the pitfalls of real property law, such as what happens when you have an eminent domain action by a local government. What happens if you've got a pre-existing mortgage, a prior interest that's foreclosed upon? What happens if there's a tax lien or a tax lien foreclosure? What happens if there's adverse possession? What happens if a court 5 years, 15 years, 30 years from now decides that on the basis of one party or the current owner's petition to toss out that use restriction? Well, the problem with that, and we're not in favor of land use restrictions, but the reason why these properties are not being cleaned up and redeveloped is because the owners, the person holding the bag, sometimes it's not the polluter, oftentimes it's a local redevelopment agency, they don't want to have a situation where 30 years from now, someone's going to take off the modern equipment, crack a concrete cap, dig through the berm, or whatever it is that control needs to do in that property, cause further environmental harm, possibly harm to human health, because that future possibility is going to bring back the liability of the original party, in this case the owner, or the responsible party. So these folks, in their calculus of decision, are deciding it's cheaper for us and less risky for us to put a fence around this thing and let it sit there forever, if need be, because we don't want to face strict contingent liability 30 years from now. We can't get insurance for it. We don't know what to do with it. So UECA is designed to protect the interests, to some degree, to protect the reasonable interests of people who own this property now, so that if the restriction is going to be taken off, if the berm is going to be dug up, if the concrete cap is going to be taken away, if they're going to rezone it for residential housing and dig wells where they really shouldn't, that original party, the signer, the person with the liability hanging out there has the ability to come in and say, no, wait. That's one thing that's new about UECA. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the development process. Virtually every group that has...
Mr. Kerr, this is a work session, okay? Not a public...
Okay, I'll stop. I'm sorry.
Hearing. Okay.
Let me just tell you this. This act has been enthusiastically received in the states. This is really the first year that we've been going out to state legislatures with this. Last year, the ABA approved it in February, and that was halfway through the session. So we had one adoption last year. The maps that I passed out, I printed on Thursday. Since then, it's been enacted in West Virginia, introduced in Colorado, and passed both houses of the legislature in Iowa. We're expecting at least two more introductions, probably within the week, one in Delaware and one in Wisconsin. What I'm saying is there's a rapid pace of adoption here. Secondly, some of the folks who are supporting it might surprise you. It's the Sierra Club. It's the American Petroleum Institute. It's the International City County Managers Association. It's the National Governors Association. It's the title insurers. It's the banks. Everyone wants to make sure that these use restrictions are protected for as long as need to be. UECA gives the people in Oregon an option to use a more robust tool to do that. And if it's adopted, that doesn't mean it has to be used. Some of the amendments that you have before you are...
The chair has no amendments have been presented to the chair.
Well, the council's got to have them on the table.
I'll repeat, the chair has received no amendments. The chair has just received the amendment.
What happened was the bill was drafted by council, and some non-uniformities crept into that, and the department rightfully pointed those out, and we've worked with council to draft these amendments to address the concerns, at least the concerns that have been identified to date to us from the department. One of the principal changes in the amendments is it makes it clear that Eureka is a standalone solution. It's, we're not trying to integrate it into the existing Chapter 465, although it's probably where it belongs ultimately when it's codified. This is meant to be a standalone tool. The department is a mandatory signatory to these things. So ultimately, the department has significant leverage in deciding whether or not to use this tool. We just urge you to make this tool available in Oregon, because I think folks from EPA Region 10 would also like to see it here. I think a lot of companies that operate in multiple states and have properties in multiple states would like to have the consistency from state to state. And frankly, one of the advantages of uniform laws like this is when you have the same language and the same provisions and the same commentary in the record from state to state, chances are when a court in Oregon is looking at a provision that arose, or looking at a dispute that arose under Eureka 5 or 10 years from now, another state has looked at that same provision and can provide some guidance to the court as to how to frame the issues. So it has the benefits of a national uniform law without some of the negatives of federal preemption, which was the other option discussed by some of the folks who are supporting this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Danko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. We are uncomfortable with this bill right now moving forward. We don't see that it's an emergency that we need to pass this session. We would much rather talk about it during the interim with the proponents and with our stakeholders to make sure it's the right thing to do for Oregon. On Friday and this morning, I received emails from four different what I call important stakeholders, environmental attorneys. This one says, all agree that this legislation may warrant consideration in the future, but also we all agree that this Uniform Act has not been evaluated for its impact on Oregon law and has not been subject to review and input from stakeholders that have historically characterized significant changes to Oregon's environmental law. Our key stakeholders are uncomfortable moving ahead right now. I got the amendments an hour ago. Our attorneys haven't looked at the amendments. I don't think it's appropriate now to pass this out.
Do we have any questions of our panel?
Are we...
Representative Green?
Are we going to be voting on the...
Well, I don't know that we just got the amendments. It's difficult. These are pretty wide grouping. Have you had any attempt, Bob, to any chance to look at these amendments at all?
Mr. Chair, draft of them, I think by Mr. Kerr, was given to our staff middle of last week. We had some input, but I understand there are some changes legislative council may have done. Our stakeholders have looked at, you know, that draft, and that is still their opinion, that they believe that this is something that should be talked about in a more slow fashion during the interim, and there's not the need for it to do it now. They haven't seen these amendments.
Mr. Bragg, what we did was when we had the meeting of stakeholders pursuant to the chair's request, I asked each of those stakeholders to please look at the Uniform Act, assuming that there would be amendments that were needed because of some, I don't know what happened with the legislative council originally, but to sort of assume that this would be the Uniform Act. At least Mr. Kerr and I are satisfied that the amendments that are before you now does bring it to the Uniform Act. And we did distribute those to the group and the stakeholders as quickly as we could. So, I mean, none of us saw the stuff that came out of legislative council's office until just very recently, but we've gone over at least once, and we're satisfied that it does do what I had asked the people to consider. So.
Okay. What I'm going to do, I think, committee, is we'll hold this bill over until Friday to allow the committee an opportunity to look at the amendments, and then if we can, ask you to come back on Friday, and we'll take another quick look at this. At this point, I'm not prepared to move the bill out. So I think we need to look at the amendments to see what they do to the bill. And I haven't had time to look at it. As I said, I just got them just now. So Any discussion on the committee? Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much.
What time would it be on Friday?
You can talk to our administrator, and he'll give you that information. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3286 and open a work session on House Bill 3313. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of 3313 with the Dash Run Amendment. When last there was, you scheduled a public hearing on this bill, I indicated that there was a need in the bill to make some amendments to achieve what the purpose of the bill. The purpose of this bill is to say when a county adopts additional criteria for a template dwelling, a template dwelling being one way to site a dwelling in a forest zone, under state law you can qualify for a template dwelling based on the number of parcels that are either wholly or partly within a 160-acre square centered on the center of the parcel. So if I came in and I wanted to get a template dwelling in a forest zone, let's say I had 20 acres, I would take 160-acre square, and I would place the center of that square in the center of my 20-acre parcels, and then I would count the number of parcels that were within that 160-acre square, that all a part of which were within that 160-acre square, and if I had enough, then I would qualify for a home on my 20 acres. And this is in a forest zone. It doesn't apply in farm zones or mixed farm and forest zones unless the predominant use of the property is for forest. So some counties have adopted additional criteria that not only require that there be a certain number of lots or parcels within that template, but also that the homes on those lots or parcels be within the template as well. State law doesn't mandate that, but some counties, or at least one county, has adopted an additional criteria that also requires that the homes be within the template as well. What this bill says is that if one of the homes is right on the line, so that they say the bedroom and the bathroom fall within the 160-acre square, but the garage and the second bedroom don't fall within the 160-acre square, because the line bisects the house, then the parcel, then the dwelling is considered to be within the template for purposes of counting the number of dwellings. It doesn't change state law to mandate that the dwellings be located within the template. It simply says if a county has gone a step further and also requires that the dwellings be within the template, and one of those dwellings falls right on the line, tie goes to the runner, and the dwelling is counted as being within the template for purposes of the template dwelling test. This issue arose in a case out of Multnomah County. Multnomah County's ordinance is more restrictive than state statute and requires that all of the dwellings, or five dwellings, be within the template. In this case, four of the dwellings were within the template, and the other one was the line cut right through the middle of the house. The county's position was that because the entire house wasn't within the template, then the house didn't qualify, and there were only four houses, and therefore the proposed dwelling had to be denied. That case was taken to LUBA, and LUBA deferred to the county's interpretation of its own ordinance like the statute requires them to do, and says, well, we can't see that this is demonstrably wrong. They didn't address the policy issues. They just said that looking at this ordinance, you can interpret it that way, and therefore we'll go ahead and affirm the county's interpretation of its own ordinance, which is probably the right decision. So the purpose of this bill is essentially to overturn that case and say tie goes to the runner, or the applicant in this case. There was no opposition to the bill in its previous when the public hearing was held, and I don't see any behind me today.
Is Kathy Warman here?
Kathleen Warman, yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Would you come up, Kathleen?
only in the committee, this is the lady, in essence, who had this happen to her and wanted the bill. And I just thought maybe you'd like to take a minute to comment to the committee or to say something. So.
Okay. Well, I live in Columbia County, and I purchased this property that is in Scappoose, but it's just over the county line, so it's in Multnomah County. And when I applied for a template test, they turned it down because one of the dwellings is cut in half by the template boundary line. And out of curiosity, I went to Columbia County Planning, and I asked the planner on duty if they have a situation where there's a template line that cuts a house in half, would they count? He said, well, yeah. So apparently, it's just interpreted differently from county to county.
Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it. Committee, have any questions?
I do.
Representative Greenway.
As usual.
David, I see two things. One is this Section 7 that does what you just said. What's the consequence of the change from or to and on line 4 of page 3?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, line 4.
I'm sorry, it's in the dash 1 amendments.
Line 4, page
2? 3.
Oh, 3.
I think that's the only other change, right? There's the addition of Section 7, and there's the.
I didn't notice that, so just a minute, and I'll read through it and try to get an answer.
He said page 3. Oh.
Well, Joe Lerard, Representative Greenwick, I don't know why where that came from. And frankly, I don't think it does. It changes or to end, but acknowledged land use regulations have to comply with the acknowledged comprehensive plan, and so it's a distinction without a difference. The state law already requires that an acknowledged land use regulation comply with the comp plan, and if it doesn't, the comp plan controls.
I'm assuming this must have been the LC.
I think so.
Giving something in order, independent. It isn't anything you have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, no.
Any further questions? Any questions from the committee? Thank you, David. Ms. Wellman, nice to meet you.
Chair,
entertain a motion to move the dash ones.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I'll move the dash ones to House Bill 3313.
Representative Smith has moved
the dash ones to House Bill 3313. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Greenman?
Aye.
Nolan?
Yes.
Anderson?
Aye.
Smith? Yes.
Sumner? Aye.
Chair Gerard?
Chair votes aye. The dash ones are moved to House Bill 3313.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Smith.
I'll move House Bill 3313 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 3313 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Greenman?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair
Gerard? Chair votes aye.
House Bill 3313 is moved to the House with a due pass recommendation. Representative Sumner, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Sumner will carry this bill. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3313 and open a work session on House Bill 3135. Ms. Arkin? Come forth and explain your dash fours and fives.
Thank you, Chair Gerard, and members of the committee. And thank you for your patience as we've worked through the amendments to this bill with the Legislative Council and honed it to address any considerations we heard during public testimony. I wanted to start, if I could, Chair Blog, by coming back to the committee and answering the questions that Representative Ackerman asked at the close of our last work session. Would that be a good way to start?
Representative Ackerman, do you have questions?
Not right now.
Okay.
She hasn't testified yet, but I did check with my county sources. I think they are in accord with what you're going to say. I'll just say that up front.
Thank you.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Okay. This is a good bill which creates a relationship between energy facility siting and energy planning. And the amendments to this bill address any concerns about possible veto power by a local government or any what's called the NIMBY factor, or not in my backyard factor. The intent of this bill is to take the land use decision that's involved with energy facility siting and bring in the local government to that land use decision. Currently, the way existing statute is, the special advisory group, which is appointed by the Energy Facility Siting Council, is the same as the local jurisdiction. Wherever an energy facility is to be sited within that boundary, that is the local jurisdiction, and then the special advisory group is constituted from the local jurisdiction. In the existing statute, that body is simply advisory, and the Energy Facility Siting Council makes a binding land use decision. This bill, with its amendments, gives the local jurisdiction or that special advisory group parity with the Energy Facility Siting Council. It gives them a substantial role to play in the land use decision, and that is very much in accordance with Oregon land use goals. The local government does best the decisions for the local land use. So that's the intent of this bill. However, the bill amendment, which is on page... I'm looking at the dashboard, and on page 4, lines 9 through 16, this bill provides for binding arbitration if for any reason the local jurisdiction or that special advisory group cannot concur with the Energy Facilities Siting Council, but that's after they've met and tried to resolve their differences. So that is that important amendment that we had just seen as we all walked into the room last time. Again, I thank you for your patience. The other amendments in the dash fours is that any facility that would cross over boundary lines, such as a natural gas pipeline, an electrical transmission line, or a wind generation facility, would, with the input from the public and the local jurisdiction, their input, the final decision would rest with the Energy Facility Siting Council because of the fact that they are going through multiple jurisdictions. Very hard to coordinate that. So that's the amendment that you see in the dash fours, page 2, starting at line 26. And again, as we discussed last time, the only difference between the dash fours and the dash fives is that the dash fours include wind generating facilities, the dash fives do not. And the last one is in section 10 of the bill, which in the dash four starts on page, not six, excuse me, section 9. Creating a task force by which interested and knowledgeable parties shall gather together, convened by the Department of Energy, to discuss ways to implement the rules to this bill so that energy facility siting is better aligned with the Oregon's energy plan and Oregon's economic plan as it relates to energy. And I'm available for questions, should there be any.
Questions?
Just you made one distinction between the four and fives, and I was turning pages and missed it, so could you go through that again and then tell us which one you want?
Yes, thank you. The dash fours have one difference from the dash fives, and you can find that difference on page to the dash fours, and I'm assuming it's same on the dash fives, in line 27 and 28, says, for a pipeline transmission line that is located in two or more local government jurisdictions or for a wind power generation project after public hearings, et cetera, et cetera. And then the dash fives, the words for a wind power generation project are not included. I do recommend a due pass for the dash fours, but leave it up to you.
Thank you. So you're saying we do want the dash fours and dash fives or just the dash fours?
Yes.
Just the dash fours.
I don't know the process, but I think that the dash fours, the way I heard it in public testimony, the dash fours address better the comments about wind generation facilities going over multiple jurisdictions. And that those would remain, in a sense, centrally cited by the Energy Facility Siting Council.
Committee, have any questions? Seeing none, Lisa, it looks like you did a good job here.
Thank you very much, Chair Gerard. Thank you, committee, for your support.
The chair will first look for a motion to move the dash fours. Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I was going to move this bill to the Environment Committee.
We are going to do that, but we have to move the dash fours in first.
I'll move the dash fours to House Bill 3135.
Representative Nolan has moved the dash four amendments into House Bill 3135. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Friedrich?
Aye.
Nolan?
No.
Anderson?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Yes.
Chair Gerard?
Chair votes aye.
Dash 4s are moved into House Bill 3135. Representative Norman? Now, remember, the committee, this bill has a recommendation to the Environment, referral to the Environment Committee.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move that we refer House Bill 3135 as amended to the House Committee on Environment without recommendation.
Representative Nolan has moved House Bill 3135 as amended to be referred to the House Environment Committee with no recommendation. Is there any further discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Nolan?
Yes.
Anderson?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair
Gerard? Chair votes aye.
House Bill 3135 is moved to the Environment Committee with a no pass, no recommendation. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3135. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2963. Sam?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the
committee. This is a bill that's come before you on several occasions in the past. There has now finally been a complete dash one, dash two amendments that would deal with it. Essentially, the dash two amendments significantly changed the original provisions of the bill. The bill is one which deals with requiring local governments within urban growth boundaries to provide for land both maintained for short and long-term supplies of those lands for industrial and commercial uses. The intent of the dash two amendments, it deals expressly with industrial lands and significantly for setting up and identifying a process that the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department would prepare an industrial trend analysis for all metropolitan planning organizations in the state by stated date of 2007 to identify large-scale industrial sites and factors that are needed to address to make those sites feasible for the large-scale industrial development. Allows for local government's involvement in the planning process for those for making that site selection, and the amendment also includes an expedited urban growth boundary amendment process to better facilitate the development of large-scale industrial sites. These were proposed by Mr. Gallagher, who headed a work group. There are also We'll point out to the committee there are a number of folks who came here last week. This item had appeared as that it would be a public hearing and work session. That was agenda was changed at the end of last week so that this is only reflected as a work session. However, there are a number of people who came on last week's information and have indicated before the meeting that they have opinions that they'd like to be able to share with the committee, if at your discretion.
And the chair will allow those people to speak today. Okay, committee, we need to deal with the Dash 2 amendments first, so I'll ask Tom Gallagher to come up, and he can tell us about the Dash 2s.
I'm Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, representing the Urban Developers Coalition. Let me put the walk through the Dash 2s. The second section is the purpose section, expanding the number of created sector industrial sites that are available and buildable in the near term. That was really the goal that I wanted to start with this bill, to accomplish two things. To find the sites that the industry was actually going to use, not just to have land that was zoned industrial. And number two, to have a number of those sites available in the near term. And that means they have services, they're zoned adequately, they're ready to build on, which is what the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department is working on now, which what they call certified sites. So while this language is technically in right now in the rules, it isn't being implemented quite this way, and so we're trying to move that through with this bill. There are four purposes, I think, that we're going to accomplish in Sections 3 and 4. First one, as I said, we're going to try and match the sites to those new industries that are looking to come to the state. That requires us to do, in my judgment, a couple of things. Number one, to bring in the group that's working most closely with these new opportunities, with these companies, and is doing the most looking at what are the site qualifications, and that's the OECDD. The way that it's currently done is to have a local city or county do a comprehensive plan, to amend the comprehensive plan, and if necessary, if they don't have adequate sites under the old definition, to do an economic opportunity analysis, which they hired done, and they're good and workable programs. But those industrial commercial sites that they're looking for are very, very broad. Anything from a small light manufacturing operation to anything that can be zoned industrial and sometimes commercial. In Section 3, we're taking that go-line definition and we're trying to narrow it down to a more specific type of site. And there are extensive drafting problems in trying to do that. You have to know what the go-line rewrite language is using, and you have to essentially talk about smaller and smaller subsets of industrial sites without kind of repeating and using the same language, so you have conflict between the rules and the statute. And that may be an art that we have not quite accomplished yet. And I don't think it's a question of disagreement, I think it's a question of drafting. If you look on page 1 in Section 3, and Section 3 is a regular planning process. It's bringing two new concepts into the normal comprehensive plan process that local governments go through. Those two processes I've talked about were regionalization and using OECDD. But in this case, we're going to define industrial land. I have a marked up piece here. We're going to define industrial land on page 2, line 14. And that term here, that's going to be used all throughout this section, is industrial use. The definition of industrial use here is a traded sector development that's been identified in the trend analysis, provides high-wage employment. High-wage employment is defined as the above-the-average wages for that county on a report put out by the Employment Division, in an amount that is significant in the urbanized area inside the Metropolitan County Organization, which means we're looking for those companies that bring in better than average jobs and that are of a substantial size. So we've narrowed the industrial definition to companies that need three qualifications. They're traded sector, they have higher wage jobs, and that will vary by community, which I think is important for rural and urban Oregon. And number three, they would bring in a substantial number of jobs. So these are the companies that are on an international or national search. They oftentimes hire a site selecting committee. They oftentimes start out with OECD, and they're looking for specific attributes. And those attributes would be defined down on page 2 and line 23 under the site characteristics. Those site characteristics are taken from the site characteristics now that OECD uses to certify their sites. Now, the matchup here, the key matchup we're looking at, is to say to each, in this case, regional jurisdiction, you need to have an adequate number of market price sites that meet this definition and then are attractive to these businesses. And that doesn't happen under our existing statutory language. In this case, the industrial trends analysis will be done by OECD for a regional group, the six metropolitan planning organizations, or any other cities and local jurisdictions that want to get together and form a region. They will receive, in this case, state-provided assistance from economic development. They'll come in and do this industrial trends analysis. They will say, these are the kinds of businesses that are looking to site in your area, and these are the kind of sites they're looking for. At that point, all supersiting or state involvement is done, and it goes back to the local jurisdictions. This data is given to the local jurisdictions. And now in section 3, on page 3, sub 4, the local jurisdictions will sit down, go inside the metropolitan planning organizations, and they may identify sites that meet the criteria. And then when they come to an opt-out section, it's up to them. They will sit down and look and say, well, we've got some land here, or we have some attractive spots here that it looks like we would attract, these organizations would like. After 180 days of this consideration, the local jurisdictions that want to will go ahead to move these sites online or begin to make them serviceable in the short term. I want to point to you next on page 4, line 10, which is the second point of this bill. It's very difficult for me to see how any local jurisdiction can argue that we've taken away any of their authority or their ability to handle their own decisions in the local community, because subsection 6 is an opt-out provision. It reads a little funny because of the way the bill is constructed, but it purely says in line 13 and 14, if the city or county did not or could not avail itself of the opportunity, which is to cite these industrial plans, it can make a written finding, in other words, tell LCDC why it's not going to do it, and it can opt out. In many of the discussions, we figure the single biggest reason why local jurisdictions will opt out is they don't have adequate resources for infrastructure planning to bring these sites online within a year. It will be money. Or number two, they don't have adequate money to do the land use planning to sit down and figure out how to identify these sites and move them inside the urban growth boundary or move them out of brownfields or whatever else they need to do to make these attractive sites available for industrial development. So the whole point of Section 6 is to say that this legislature will get another round of information as to why these types of industrial sites just can't or won't. It won't, it's okay, and I'm pointing to that. If the jurisdiction says, we don't want any industrial development here, they can opt out under this clause, and I'm fine with that. I don't think there's anything negative in that. There's nothing intended in the bill to be negative about that. But we all know that there are some jurisdictions where there won't growth to occur, and there are some jurisdictions which are comfortable to be the same way they are right now. So that's the opt-out provision, and those are what I consider to be the biggest local government protections in the bill. There is an ability to move the urban growth boundary here, which in a sense would mean they can go outside on the farmland. There are two places where you can do that. In Section 7 on page 4, that whole section there gives the local jurisdiction the ability to speed up the process of moving the urban growth boundary. It does it by allowing the industrial trends analysis on line 21 to satisfy the needs analysis required in the state land use planning goals. Ladders will be a 5 to 6. Your guess is as good as mine how much faster that would mean, because a local jurisdiction now has an analysis that says we need these sites. The other place where they can go outside the urban growth boundary, I'll come to in a section because in a second, because it's in section 5. This has a fiscal. It will should go to Ways and Means. It will require OECD to either contract with some folks to do this or to take on for themselves a different way of helping and assisting local governments in economic development planning. Section 5, is much more of a result of a work group than it is mine. I was more interested in Section 5. But Section 4. Section 5 we call euphemistically the bird in the hand. If the new intel comes to town and wants to be in the local area, has found a piece of property, and would like to site there, and that piece of property is in competition with Denver and Houston and the other places, this is a means for the local government, not the state, not any supersiding authority, but for the local government to speed up moving the urban growth boundary to bring in that piece of property. This has a very narrow definition of the types of industries, and those are on 15, page 5. Here we use the term large-scale industrial use. And as other people come up and talk about this language, I want you to be very careful. I don't think it's perfect yet, but the distinction here is industrial use in one and large-scale industrial use in the other. These are traded sector developments that provide at least 250 high-wage jobs, have $100 million of facility and investment, and are developed to the level of 15 jobs per developable acre, which is my understanding Metro right now uses an average of 9 jobs. So 15 is a very high level of skilled jobs in this area. This very limited number of industries can find a piece of property, and they can come to the local jurisdiction under section line 27. They can use this process, this expedited process, to assist in moving the UGB. It's not automatic. It only satisfies two of the elements of the need process. It's the need to show that there's a need for the new sites, and then to go through the allocation or the hierarchy of land they can move on. So they still have to go through the process to move the urban growth boundary. Two of the steps are truncated, and that's all that happens here. So essentially, Mr. Chair, those are the pieces of the amendment. Let me finish by saying that I've been going through College Plain Arts. One of the philosophical problems they pondered was, if everything can be divided by two, can the arrow ever reach the target? And this is the first time I've had a practical experience in that false statement. Because as much work as we put into this, I don't think even the agreeable groups are willing. And I am asking you not to keep this bill here. I have done everything I can. I'm asking you to make a decision. There are other opportunities to tweak or sub-tweak some of the definitions. I've heard some of the thoughts. I do not think from the people in the work group there's philosophical differences with the bill, but they'll be able to speak to that. So there will be at least two other stops where, if it's necessary to tweak the bill, we can do that. So with that, I'll stop.
Tom, would you identify who some of the folks were that were in the work group with you?
I think the people who are here today, what I would ask you to get their advice from are LCDC, OECDD, the cities and the counties, and perhaps Metro. Each of these people, in the course of all this discussion, has some good comments, some good observations. We just weren't able, in the time period, to get that down in the bill.
Any questions of Mr. Gallagher? Representative Greenleck.
Very brief one, sir. Tom, could you help me with traded sector? One of the examples we talked about the other day when we talked about this was the Winco Distribution Center. Would that qualify as a traded sector under 285B280?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleck, I don't think I'm qualified to answer that yes or no. I will say that in the 6 years that I've been doing this, there has been a great deal of effort put into defining industrial and to defining what we're talking about here. The reason the term traded sector has been put into everything since, I think, House Bill 2011 was because traded sector basically referenced to those goods that are sold in across state lines and interstate business as opposed to those goods and services that are only sold locally. I would not know enough about the details of your question, but if I had a distribution warehouse that did wholesaling for the entire West Coast, I might be a traded sector warehouse. If I had a distribution warehouse for McDonald's hamburgers in the valley, I might not be one, and I think that OECDD or LCDC would be able to answer that better.
If I could just read the definition. It says traded sector means industries in which member firms sell their goods or services into markets for which national and international competition exists. I mean, by using that, is it intended to narrow this definition or expand it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, in all the discussions I've been in, it narrows it quite narrowly in a sense. It takes out big box retail, for example, and that's the principal reason it's used. Big box retail is not sold in national or international competition. That's a local function. And it again attempts to look at those kinds of businesses which are doing business on a broader scale, an extra state scale.
Any other questions, Mr. Gallagher? Tom, thank you for your work on this bill. I'd like to see if I can get Linda Ludwig, Art Schlack. Is Randy Tucker here? No, I don't see Randy. And a representative from Bob Windy, if you could come up, and OECDD. That's who I would like to hear from, because they were all people who worked as part of this task force, just to get your opinion on whether you feel this bill is getting the job done for you. So, ready for prime time, as Representative Greenwick says. Then we will give all the other folks who are here an opportunity to speak. The committee is receiving a letter from Lane Shetterly at the moment. Bob, would you go ahead and start, and we'll just work my right to left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Lindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And we have been a member of the work group, and we've been working diligently with Tom Gallagher and others. Because we are in support of the basic premise of this bill, it has been our work, certainly in this last biennium after the passage in House Bill 2011 last session, to spend a great deal of our effort as an agency in trying to increase the supply of market-ready industrial sites statewide. And that's a difficult task, not only for us but for local governments, because as you heard a minute ago, of course, one of the main impediments to this is services, infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, sewer and water infrastructure, and some other things of that nature. But without question, the proper way from a land use standpoint to identify these sites has typically been a needs analysis. It comes from a variety, there's a variety of names for it. We call them economic opportunities analysis. This bill calls it industrial trends analysis. But those analyses are the tool by which local governments identify where they should locate industrial sites, what kind of land is needed for the kind of industry that they're trying to attract, a variety of things of that nature. And one of the fundamental premises of Section 4 of this bill is that to the extent we can do those analyses by region, or at least for the large regions of the state, in advance, on an accelerated time frame, and we propose here to do that through OECDD, I think we not only save money rather than have each and every jurisdiction or UGB statewide do this analysis, but also we probably speed up those analyses by at least a factor or two and maybe more. So we're behind the the premises here in Section 4, which I think substitutes those analyses, is intended to substitute the regional analysis for the what's currently a local analysis. And Section 5 is something we also supported in the work group. It's intended very narrowly for some for large-scale industrial uses. The term we coined was bird in hand, but it's for a big deal industrial prospect that comes along. It's going to provide at least 250 jobs, and my understanding is we've had 9 or 10 of these in the last few years. They come in, look for a site. If they don't find one in an UGB, this bill authorizes those to locate a site that's immediately outside of UGB and on a very fast accelerated process bring those into the boundary much faster than you could today using state's land use rules. We have a number of issues we've outlined in the letter. I don't intend to go into those. I have sympathy for the complexity of this for Legislative Council and Tom Gallagher to try to draft this in a very short period of time, and we weren't able to help the last 2 days because LCDC was meeting and that took all of my time. But I believe the issues we've identified in the letter are, by and large, are drafting things we can take care of. I think we have general agreement on most of these points. It's just a matter of getting the language right. So we're in support of the bill as it stands today, and it's our understanding from Mr. Gallagher we could continue to work on these things as it goes up to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Bob. Good afternoon.
Representative Gard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Gregg-Spain from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. The OECDD has appreciated the opportunity to work with Tom Gallagher and the other members of the work group on this bill. We are also very interested in seeing this bill go forward. We believe that it provides valuable services for local governments, and we are very interested in being able to provide an industrial trends analysis to local governments. With that said, we do have a couple of concerns about the bill as it was drafted, and I should mention that there does seem to be a few changes in this draft that we just received today, and we would like a little bit more time to be able to review it and comment. One of the things that is of concern to OECDD is the last element of the industrial trends analysis. Our vision of the analysis has been, I think, a little bit broader than is reflected here. The last element would have OECDD identifying both the land that the industrial lands that are currently available, the lands that are needed, and then doing the math to let the local government know specifically what land is still needed. This is a narrower vision, a more refined vision of the industrial trends analysis than what OECDD had been discussing and considering. We would like to continue to discuss this point. We're just not sure at this point whether we could provide that precise of information to a local government. The second point about the industrial trends analysis that I wanted to make is that in the definition of site characteristics, it includes a reference to availability of land at a purchase price. And I just don't think that OECDD is going to be able to determine what land is up for sale at any point in time throughout the entire area. That's a very big task. So we would like to see that issue addressed. Finally, the department doesn't currently have funding available to do the industrial trends analysis, and I know this is going up to Ways and Means, but I just wanted to flag that issue. On a rather technical point, the bill makes reference to the department in a couple of locations, and this language will be going into DLDC's statutes, and those statutes define the term department to refer to Mr. Rindy's department and not to OECDD, so I think that clarification should be made. The final comment on Section 4 that I'd like to make is that I think OECDD agrees with the intent when the bill says that the industrial trends analysis would be used to satisfy the Goal 14 requirements. But I would just like to see the phrasing made strongly enough that it actually replaces the Goal 14 requirements, so that the scrutiny that would be put on that trends analysis wouldn't be matched up with Goal 14, but would be matched up with the requirements of this bill. There's also a reference to a database that OECDD would put together, and we would just like to get some more information about the contents of that database in order for us to fulfill the expectations here. And finally, in Section 5, the hurdle for industries is set quite high. And I would just want to let this committee know that I've been told that only 8 projects in the last 10 years would have met the requirements here. If that's what's intended, that's fine with OECDD. But we just want you to be aware that this is a very high hurdle for a company to pass.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Ludwig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. You've heard quite a few details here, both from Mr. Rendy and OECDD, so my comments are going to be brief. We view this bill still, this language that you have before you today, as a work in progress. You've heard that it does have a state fiscal to OECDD. It does. And it also could have a fiscal to local governments as they go ahead. And if they opt in to go ahead and update their capital improvement plans and do the designations here. You've heard from us before about the problems that we have citing industrial sites and how infrastructure funding is so tied to that. This bill doesn't touch infrastructure funding, and we do look forward to the day that the state and the legislature can move hand in hand with local governments and try to address that need so that we can make an appropriate difference in actually really bringing more employers to the state of Oregon. The language in this bill is not perfect, and we don't believe at this point in time this bill will do a whole lot without that infrastructure investment as well. But we certainly have been working with Mr. Gallagher. We are supporting the efforts of this bill. We'll continue to work with the language in the bill and both of the agencies and try to move forward on this very, very important issue.
Thank you. Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slapp with the Association of Oregon Counties, and we too have been part of the work group. I've been working to try and come up with some creative other approaches for siting industrial land within the state of Oregon and maintain local responsibility and local control. Now, that's sometimes a very hard thing to do, to try and do both of those. But that's, from our vantage point, that's what we've been trying to do. I think there is a lot of good concepts in the bill as drafted. I would agree with Ms. Ludwig that I would view this as work in progress. There are issues that we have identified that we wish to continue to work on. However, I would just indicate to you that I think probably the biggest hurdle that this bill will overcome, or need to overcome, is the fiscal. And so I am very comfortable having this bill move to Ways and Means so that we can look at the fiscal impact as well as continue to work on, shall I say, some of the details that there are concerns that, you know, continue to, let's say, bother us to a degree that we need to work on. As Ms. Ludwig indicated, there is potentially a significant fiscal to the Department of Economic Development. These need to be new funds. We would not support the passage of this bill and the funds that would be needed to undertake these programs or industrial trend analysis coming from existing department programs at this point. That just won't work to rob Peter to pay Paul at this point. And I just want to put that on the record now. That for us to support this type of for proposal, we do need to talk about new funds, and Ways and Means is the appropriate place to really have that discussion at this point. We stand ready to continue to work on this proposal. This section dealing with the bird in hand is a very special section. To really address somebody coming from out of state that is a very large employer that really can't find a suitable site inside an urban growth boundary and has to look outside. And so I, at least as we view it, it is an extremely special kind of proposal, and I would anticipate there would not be very many a year that would probably qualify. You don't get too many people coming to the state of Oregon that has a commitment to put $100 million of infrastructure and facilities into a development within a year or two. That's a rare occasion, but we do see that, and we need to have the door open and welcome those situations. With that, Mr. Chair, it's an overview, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do that.
Any questions of this panel by the committee? Wow. Thank you. I know you all worked very hard on this, and as Ms. Ludwig indicated, this is still a work in progress, so we appreciate it. Tom Gallagher, the only fiscal we have on this bill was on the original bill and not on the Dash 1 amendments. What are your thoughts there, whether we should move this bill or refer it to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, representing the Urban Developers Coalition. I know that both the local governments and OECDD, and probably to some extent maybe even LCDC, are working on their fiscals on the Draft 1 amendments. It seems to me that I respect what Mr. Schlack said, that if this bill is going to die, it ought to die in Ways and Means for lack of funding. And why put everybody through the effort of clearing over the bill if it isn't going to get to the funding process? So it's up to you. I think I'm quite comfortable sending it to Ways and Means.
Yes, thank you very much. Now we have some folks, and Representative Krummel has come in and is also asked to speak on this bill. At this point, Representative, we are intending to move the bill to Ways and Means. So I don't know if that determines whether you still would like to speak in regards. All right, please come forward. We also have Mayor Leon here. We missed you last week. Are there any other elected officials here that wish to testify? Okay. Representative Krummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Mr. Chair, a couple of comments about the 2963-2 amendments that I have a little bit of concern about. And on line 23 on the first page, it talks about the in a short-term supply of land, that the land is serviceable and ready for construction within 1 year. There's not a definition of serviceable either in the bill that I could find, and I don't know about another part of the statute. What I'm going to assume, and I recognize, Mr. Chair, that a person should never assume because of what it does to both you and me, but I'm going to assume that that serviceable means that it has infrastructure to it. Water, sewer, electrical utilities, gas utilities, those sorts of things. The question then becomes, who is going to provide those services if those services are not available but could be made available within 1 year? The other question then that it brings up is that if a community said that they could not service it, and a special district did not want to service the area that's being looked at, does that mean that the development, irrespective of its size, can go ahead and drill wells, even if they're in a critical water area of the state? Or it also brings up the question of whether or not they can put a drain field in, irrespective of how large of a drain field they may need. So I think that that needs to be defined a little bit more if this, as we're looking at this from a policy perspective. The other thing is that when you look at Section 4, when I look at Section 4 anyway, on page 2, lines 23 through about 30, the six characteristics that it talks about, one of the, and then over on to the next page as well, but one of the things that I'm concerned about is it says on line 24, proximity to major multimodal freight transportation routes. That tells me that you're looking for air, rail, highway, most likely interstate types of freeways. So what I think we're doing here is that we are pretty much putting it along the I-5 corridor or along the Interstate 84 corridor, and that's it. So what happens to the central part of the state, and what kind of proximity do they have along Highway 97 or along Highway 22? What about the smaller communities on the east side of the state that, you know, when the Portland area was booming and had 4.2% unemployment, Gillam County had 19% unemployment, Harney County had 21% unemployment, and we weren't doing, quite frankly, anything to help those communities and those counties try to get any kind of economic development. And I'm not sure that this bill goes anywhere to help with that. On page 3 in section 4A at line 22 through 27, it says that within 180 days after completion of the industrial trend analysis for an urbanized area having a metropolitan planning organization, which to me this is pretty much pointed right at the metro area, it has permissive language in there that a city or county may identify sites that meet the criteria in the industrial trend analysis. But what happens if they don't identify sites? What if they don't choose to identify any sites, because that language is permissive? And then over on page 4, from lines 4 through 9, I haven't quite figured out yet what the incentive to the cities are for determining that, because it says when a city or county designates a site for industrial use, and that was, I alluded to that on the previous page, the city or county shall, and then it goes through a couple of things here. Well, basically what that's telling the city or county that they must do is that they must spend money on that infrastructure. What if the proposed development is quite a ways from the city and quite a ways from a special district? What incentive is there going to be for a local government to try and service that area? I think as I sort of look through the bill, Mr. Chair, or look through the amendments, Mr. Chair, I think there's some concerns, and I know that constituents in my area have some other concerns relative to that, and that's one of the reasons why Mayor Lehan is here. I think that I'm not sure that this is quite ready yet. It's in the hopper. I'm not sure that it's percolated enough yet, as you like to say in land use, before it's really ready to go. And I would suggest that at this point it's not, and it needs a little bit of further work. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity.
Mayor, good afternoon.
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity once again to come before you. And did you get my pictures? You both spoke there.
Did you get my pictures?
Oh.
For something different, I brought you some visual aids. Because the last time I was here, we heard testimony that Wilsonville would not be willing to take a Winco distribution center, and I just want to point out that indeed we have many distribution centers, and we do trucks in a big way, and this is a lottery-funded project, 95th Avenue, that resulted in 3,500 jobs of the 18,000 jobs that we have in Wilsonville right now. So Winco is, I want to make it, I'll be sure I'm on the public record here, that Winco is welcome in Wilsonville, irrespective of the previous testimony. I would agree with previous people who testified here that this this bill needs work. It needs a lot of work because much of it is confusing and even contradictory. But rather than start here and pick it apart line by line, which I would be willing to do, I think we need to ask what the problem is that we're trying to solve. Because at least here in the Willamette Valley and especially in the Portland metro area, the problem is not a lack of industrial land inside the UGB, but a lack of infrastructure, as you've heard time and time again. Metro just expanded the UGB by 4,500 acres specifically for industrial use last year, and that was following an 18,000-acre expansion in 2002, none of which, I'm pretty confident, has been master planned or has infrastructure to serve it. So now the cities are all faced with the need to master plan these areas and to plan and fund and build the infrastructure to serve it. House Bill 2963, at least the way the amendments are written right now, carries the false assumption that the act of annexing land, especially these very large tracts of land, will somehow magically make infrastructure appear in only 1 year time. And that's what it's requiring here, that it would be serviceable in 1 year. And up front says this is to address the short-term supply issue. There's no way it can address a short-term supply because there's no way that any of these sites can be any more than the ones that came in 2002 and are now sitting inside the urban growth boundary and waiting for to be made serviceable. So let me step you through. You heard about we want to expedite this, but when they talk about expediting, they're just talking about expediting the annexation process. So let's start from there. Even that they're saying will take 180 days. But let's assume the land is annexed. From there you have to do, at the local government level, you have to do master planning. That's going to involve coordination with the landowners, negotiations with them, public outreach, hearings, engineering studies, transportation studies, urban planning and design, all the things that go into master planning, and at the very least, approval by the local planning commission and the local city council. After that, assuming it's approved through that process, you need to address the funding issues. You have to see what funds are needed. And if you're going to change your CIP and create a funding mechanism like an urban renewal district or an LID, that in itself has its own notice and hearing requirements. And from there, you have to secure the funds to actually do the infrastructure. And then after that, you get into doing final design, engineering, and impact studies. Those can take easily a year's time. And then that doesn't still get you the federal and state permits that are often required for large infrastructure projects, nor build them. And just a road project like 95th Avenue, a new road like that can easily cover two construction seasons. So if we're talking about going out into green fields where there is no infrastructure at all, there's no way that can happen in a year's time. And anyone who's worked in local government could tell you these steps, from the master planning to the finance to getting the funds to building the infrastructure, doesn't happen that fast. And furthermore, efficient provision of industrial infrastructure needs to be planned on a system-wide basis. That's why CIPs are done on a 5-year rolling planning basis. I'll try to
close here and say that Wilsonville has, inside our UGB alone, 1,200 plus industrial acres. And those are inside the UGB now. So to say that what we need is to add more land is it just is the wrong place to be putting the efforts of OECDD. If the legislature really wanted to encourage industrial development rather than encourage land speculation, which is what this bill primarily does, then they would be working with smaller cities to leverage the projects like 95th Avenue that small cities need to be able to get attract industrial development. And I just want to say one thing about the about Section 5, which in my mind looks suspiciously like a sweetheart deal. But I want to point out, when people have said that this is a very high hurdle and these are high skill levels, part of why I say this needs a lot of work. If you do the math on this, it says 15 jobs per acre on a project that is at a minimum 100 acres, a maximum 300 acres. So that's somewhere between 1,500 and 4,000 jobs. And only 250 of them need to be even above average. I've read this multiple times. There's no way to read this. The project has to have 250 high-wage jobs, irrespective of its size. And yet it says that it's a minimum of 100 acres, and they're going to have 15 jobs minimum per acre, per developed acre. That gives you massive employment numbers that are way more than 250. And no matter how big those employment numbers are, only 250 need to be even above average for the county we're in. So this is in my mind, not a high hurdle. It's a high hurdle for the size, but it's not a high hurdle for high wage. And 15 jobs per acre is not a high skill job ratio per acre. In our high tech industry at Mentor Graphics or InFocus, it's closer to 300 jobs per acre. These are our high tech buildings and high tech office buildings, research and development. 15 per acre is not what you get out of a high tech. It's much higher. And I would, like I say, I could go through it and mention a lot of things about it, but it definitely needs work.
Any comments? Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr.
C.K. Patterson, Alex McPhail, Tony Holt, if you would all come up and try to hold your comments as brief as you possibly can, please, in that we've pretty well determined that this bill is a work in progress.
Outside the valley, yeah. Inside the valley, it's got to be.
Mr. Chairman, honorable members of the committee, thank you for your indulgence in hearing us again today, despite this being a working session or a work session as opposed to a public hearing. I was here a couple of weeks ago in support of 2963 as it was then published or available to the public, thinking that it had the makings of a bill that could be converted to support economic development in rural Oregon. I would have to change that today. And I need to say I would disagree with the idea that it's ready to move to Ways and Means. In the last year, Mr. Gallagher simply waved away the published version, saying it was never the intent to proceed in that form. And therefore, as near as I know, the bill has never had a public hearing in its current form. And today, Mr. Gallagher was unable to give you definitions that are important in the bill.
and the other people on the panel were unable to tell you how their departments would work with the assignments that are given to them in the bill. What's now proposed is unneeded, it's unfunded, and it's unlikely to do what it purports to achieve. And so it seems to me it's not ready to move. The Urban Developers Coalition kind of reminds me of the old fellow in Mississippi who was accused of being greedy and allowed us how he was not. All he wanted was the land next to his. And as you can tell, that's got an unlimited boundary. It will go forever. It strikes me in the definition of traded sectors that agriculture is a traded sector. So do all ag lands adjacent to urban growth boundaries automatically become qualified for instant process into the urban growth boundary or into industrial sites? I think Portland's metro area, to which this proposal is clearly customized, doesn't need this bill. But rural Oregon still needs your help, and I hope you'll take the time and give the agencies time to do a thoughtful, careful job of crafting legislation to achieve that goal. Thank you again for your indulgence in hearing us today.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Alex McPhail, and in the interest of expediting the process, may I have your permission to just submit 20 copies of my testimony?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tony Holt, and although I am associated with the Charbonneau Country Club, I like to think that I'm here today really as a private citizen, because I do feel that the comments I have would be made by private citizens if they were aware of the bill, which as you know, of course, most are not. I've got really just two quick points. Almost exactly a year ago, I gave testimony at the public hearing before the Metro Council in Wilsonville. The meeting was at the Holiday Inn, in the ballroom of the Holiday Inn that night, and the ballroom was crowded. And most of the people there wanted to give testimony about the various proposals for the extension of the Metro boundary, the urban growth boundary. The chairman of Metro, to his very great credit, I think, said that the Metro Council would stay there as long as it took to hear everybody who wanted to speak. And that meeting did, in fact, go on for a long time that night. It seemed to me that was real democracy in action. And I mention that, Mr. Chairman, because I have great concern here that there's no provision within this bill at all for the citizen to be involved. There's no provision for listening to the grassroots, and it seems as though really the framers of these amendments want to push through the process on behalf of whoever it is they're representing with very little minimum citizen involvement. Of course, there is provision for the local government to be involved, but really that is not the citizen involvement that I'm looking for. That brings me to my second point, and perhaps a more vital point. We already have a satisfactory process, the urban growth boundary process, and the mayor has mentioned that. And you're aware that in Wilsonville, they have some 1,200 acres already available. Some has got infrastructure already in place. Some they're working hard to put infrastructure in. I just can't see why we would want to circumvent this well-established process, but not only that, also set up the competition with the local governments who are already willing and able to provide sufficient land now and who've invested the funds to make it attractive. It just seems to me it doesn't make sense. There may be aspects, as Mr. Patterson said, maybe aspects of this bill that are attractive to eastern and southern Oregon, but I don't feel that there's a need for this bill in the Willamette Valley. We've already got that excellent long-established process, and I think it's working well. There's no need for the new process to compete with what's going on already, and it happened that the interests outside, who currently happen to have interests outside the urban growth boundary, are pushing, it seems to me, this competition. I see no emergency here, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you for having the opportunity to speak to the committee and to you.
Any questions of this panel from the committee? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And our final two persons who would like to testify, Debbie Smith and Danielle Collin. Good afternoon, ladies.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Oh. Are you here that long?
Do you like it? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak to you today. I have to tell you, there aren't many things that will compel me to speak in public, but this is one of them. And let me get past this. My name is Debbie Smith. I live in Wilsonville, and I'm also a member of the Coalition to Save the Valley. And I'm a proud farmer's daughter. And I think this bill will have a profoundly negative impact on farming in the Willamette Valley. If this bill passes, industry will move south of the Willamette River, with buildings and warehouses, gas stations, and cement running haphazardly down the valley. I think we call that urban sprawl. And they'll be doing this on some of the richest farmland, not only in Oregon, but in the country. And ag itself, I think it's important to know, to remember that ag itself is an industry. It supplies over 97,000 jobs with $5.3 billion in economic activity in Oregon. But for me, I'm really going to take a breath. For me, most importantly, the key issue is once we decide to build on the soil, there's no going back. We can't turn around and say, oops, we've made a mistake, let's unbuild that. It's there. We can't do anything different with it. And prime farmland, which is what the Willamette Valley is not a renewable resource. It's not something that we can, even though some folks like to think it's unlimited, it's not something that we can just create. We lose the jobs, we lose the crops, we lose the exports, the revenue, and the land itself. And I know you've heard this over and over again, the save the farmland mantra. But I also believe that agriculture is vital to our industry, and it's an industry that deserves to be protected just like others and considered just like others. Let's not allow our ag land to be taken away by the whims of special interest. Other areas of the country have recognized farmland as vital, and they've taken steps to preserve it and protect it. Instead of trying to parcel off the Willamette Valley farmlands piecemeal, let's instead work to protect these soils and protect them with everything we've got and allow the farming industry to thrive. I respectfully urge you to vote no on this bill, and I thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today to you on House Bill 2963. Normally I'd be in the back of the room taking notes and not talking, but that's in my capacity as the Public Affairs Director and Governmental Affairs Director for the City of Wilsonville. But in my prior job, I was the Policy and Communications Manager for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, so I think I have a little bit of knowledge about this topic. My team specifically was responsible for the research and development policy team for the OECDD. So I, having worked in that agency and worked in state agencies overall, I know that it's a little difficult to come before you in that capacity and talk about impacts. I know that state agencies will do what they are asked and what the Legislative Assembly requires. But I can assure you, having worked in that capacity, that it has an economic and fiscal impact on the agency. Some of the numbers I heard floating around outside of this meeting was $1 million. And I can see where that could be possible. I can say that because last year the City of Wilsonville had to conduct a similar kind of study at a very general level on the impacts on our infrastructure if we were to develop south of the river. To hire an outside firm to do that kind of general look was $30,000 for the City of Wilsonville. Most cities can't afford that. But we felt it was pretty important because we had a developer ready and willing to start moving south of the river, and we really wanted to have that examined. The interesting thing about that study is that we found out in order to serve property south of Gilbert, it would cost $104 million. And that would be $35.6 million for the water system, $25.3 for the sanitary system, $30.3 for the transportation system, and $2.5 for the stormwater. And that's not including what ODOT estimated that they would be required to put into it, which was another $30 million. So we're not talking easy, let's go on to the next property, and it won't impact the surrounding communities. It's a very big undertaking. It's very costly. And as it's been said here a number of times already, we have land that we've already invested in inside the UGB. And even if you have a big fish, why wouldn't you land it there first? Why would you go and spend these kinds of monies? And really, it is impossible for a year. I mean, it took us a year just to get the study results practically. So it's kind of an impossible task, and it doesn't seem to be solving the problem that you want to solve. And I think that's important. The other thing I just want to point out real quickly about the high wage. Also, economic development, I was responsible to manage the economist and his group. And high-wage jobs here is really deceptive. What it says is it's the average wage of the private sector. And if you think about that, that it would include the retail sector, the food service industry, and many others, which can be at minimum wage and not a very high-wage job. It could also include seasonal workers, which work 3 to 6 months a year and then are laid off the rest of the time. So I think you really have to look at that definition and not necessarily believe that you're going to get a high-wage kind of industry in there. It could very easily be a call center that will impede on the resources of the entire region, not just a community. The city could cite it there because it seems profitable for their tax base, but let's face it would have a huge impact on the surrounding communities. So I think you might want to consider the high wage as it's defined here as well. So I appreciate the time to speak, but I thought those were a little different points than might have been made today, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate the convenience of putting industrial things into a well-planned area for industry, but just out of interest, is not the land, the 1,200 acres, was that not farmland at one point?
Chair Guard, Representative Anderson, parts of it were it was in floodplain and in other areas it was dry farmed for a while. It was redirected land. It's north of north and east of where Danish Hospital was for the most part, and now that's going to be developed and is being developed as a mixed-use urban village of a very large size. And the prison is urban. Yes, at some point it was, but it was land that was not good ag land that was dry farmed, and the water was redirected to accomplish that, and has eroded immensely many of the streams in that area, and they're now trying to restore those. So it wasn't a good idea at the time. It still isn't a good idea to farm it. So. Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
You commented that you were a farmer's daughter. Are you farming now?
We are not farming now. My father is retired, but we farmed in Bend, raising hay and alfalfa and beef, sheep, and pigs.
And if I might follow up.
Follow.
I don't know if you have children, but if you do, what kind of job do you think they're likely to have?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would hope I don't have children, but I would hope that I would encourage them in whatever interests them. But if you're asking, do I see a viable life in farming, I certainly do. In fact, most of the farms we have are family driven. But is it easy? It's not easy. And especially if we have an industry trying to take the prime soils out from under good farms, it makes it tougher and tougher every time we do that.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I'm sorry I didn't address you properly.
That's fine. That's not a big
thank
deal.
Thank you, ladies, very much. In that we did originally post this as a public hearing, I want to make sure that anyone who, and then had a gut and stuffiness and sent the bill. Is there anyone else who would like to make a brief statement to the committee in regards to this bill? Okay, seeing none. Sure. Representative Nolan.
Could I get a clarification from Mr. Gallagher?
Sir, McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Gallagher, I want to make sure I'm understanding Section 5 correctly. And testimony we've had recently after you testified has given an interpretation on it that I hadn't seen myself. And I want to know whether it is consistent with what you intend that section to do. Specifically, the question around 250 high-wage jobs on a minimum of 100 acres, even if you assume some of the 100 acres is in roads and right-of-way, you've got 60 usable acres probably. That would be at 15 jobs an acre, 900 jobs. My question is, did you intend that only 250 of those had to be above the county's average wage, or did you intend that it had to provide at least 250 jobs and all of them had to be above the county's minimum wage or average wage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, my answer will be partially incomplete. I think maybe Bob Rindy could help you. That's a section and criteria that he developed. My understanding in the discussion group was that the purchase of the acreage had to be 100 acres, and that not all of the 100 acres need to be developed. For example, if you purchase something like Intel or Nike for a campus development, you may develop it in phases. And that's why the language says 15 jobs per developable acre. So if the original phase of the project came in and did 40 acres. Secondly, my understanding is when you use the term developer acreage, you mean all of the acreage that's under any of the requirement, the parking lots, the landscaping, the buffer zones, all of the other pieces are considered to be developable rather than the building itself. Thirdly, the issue here is that I think it is not excluded, but I think you're hedging the line here between high-rise office buildings, which would have numerous different, it would be a development of a building which would have numerous different clients in it, numerous different businesses and so forth, and an actual industrial site, which probably doesn't include research lab, but not all of the purchasing and all of the other elements that would make a Mentor Graphics have that much of a density. But again, I would say that the way it was explained here was certainly not what we talked about in putting these criteria together. So I would defer to my colleague.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think take credit to, or blame for the number in that it's difficult to try and draft for a committee that I think generally was trying to recognize this opportunity for something that was very large, and we used all kinds of terms, the oh my god, big deal industrial projects that come along. Our intent was 250 jobs and that the average wage for that industry was at least the same or larger than the average wage for the county. That definition, I think, came out of economic development, but wasn't something that we specified in terms of jobs per acre. I think that came in at the Legislative Council stage. We didn't recommend a specific number of jobs per acre, that Section C. I think Section C is problematic. We had considered something to that effect at one point, but it does, I think in any way you look at this, it's going to be very difficult to task a city or county with counting future jobs. And for that reason, the way we would have drafted that section would have been to rely primarily on the investment amount. I would not want to see a statute charge a local government with trying to predict whether a proposal, a building permit, is going to have 250 jobs or 500 or any number, because local governments can't easily predict that or compute it. On the other hand, if we want to pass muster with this task to make sure there's a certain amount of investment, I think it's more feasible. And so we would have drafted it slightly different, as you note in our comments, I think.
One quick follow-up, I think.
Follow.
And I think this, I don't know whether it goes to Mr. Rindy or Mr. Gallagher. If the emphasis is on the value of the facilities, is there anything here that requires that investment be on the property tax rolls? Can a local government cut a deal to waive property tax assessments on that investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan.
Any government, local or state?
The focus of this section was to try and pull out those very few, very large businesses, Sumitomo, Hyundai, others. Almost all of them are going to use the other provisions of the enterprise zone tax credits or another incentive done through the governor's office through OECDD to attract that particular set of jobs here. So we were not excluding in anything in this language the ability of those local jurisdictions or OECDD to put together a package to attract that industry. The focus was on trying to define what would be a very large, very substantial, high-paying industry for these particular to take advantage of that particular section 5. And that's what we talked about.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Chair would entertain a motion on the -2 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson has moved the -2 amendments into House Bill 2963. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I just wanted you to know I will be voting no. I don't think this bill is ready for prime time, and there's certainly troubles with the -2 amendments.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Greenland? Nolan?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Smith?
No.
Sumner?
No.
Chair
Gerard? Chair votes aye. The -2 amendments fail. Representative Anderson. Go on the Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2963 to Ways and Means referral.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2963 to be referred to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
With no recommendation.
The clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Greenland? Nolan?
No.
Anderson?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Sumner?
No.
Chair Gerard?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2963 fails. And we close the work session on House Bill 2963 in committee. Seeing that we have completed our agenda, we are adjourned.